The 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon by Karl Marx. Chapter 1. Hegel says somewhere that the great historic facts and personages recur twice. He forgot to add, once as tragedy, and again as farce. Cassadier for Danton, Louis Blanc for Robespierre, the mountain of 1848 to 51 for the mountain of 1793 to 05, the nephew for the uncle. The identical caricature marks also the conditions under which the second edition of the 18th Brumaire is issued. Man makes his own history, but he does not make it out of whole cloth. He does not make it out of conditions chosen by himself, but out of such as he finds close at hand. The tradition of all past generations weighs like an Alp upon the brain of the living. At the very same time when men appear engaged in revolutionizing things and themselves, in bringing about what never was before, at such very epochs of revolutionary crisis, do they anxiously conjure up into their service the spirits of the past, assume their names, their battle cries, their costumes, to enact a new historic scene in such time-honored disguise and with such borrowed language. Thus did Luther masquerade as the Apostle Paul. Thus did the Revolution of 1789 to 1814 drape itself alternately as the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. Nor did the Revolution of 1818 know what better to do than to parody at one time the year 1789, at another the revolutionary traditions of 1793 to 95. Thus does the beginner, who has acquired a new language, keep on translating it back into his own mother tongue. Only when he has grasped the spirit of the new language, and is able freely to express himself therewith, when he moves in it without recollections of the old, and has forgotten in its use his own hereditary tongue. When these historic configurations of the dead past are closely observed, a striking difference is forthwith noticeable. Camille Desmoulins, Danton, Robespierre, Saint-Just, Napoleon, the heroes as well as the parties and the masses of the old French Revolution, achieved in Roman costumes and with Roman phrases the task of their time, the emancipation and the establishment of modern bourgeois society. One set knocked to pieces the old feudal groundwork and mowed down the feudal heads that had grown upon it. Napoleon brought about, within France, the conditions under which alone free competition could develop. The partition lands be exploited, the nation's unshackled powers of industrial production be utilized, while, beyond the French frontier, he swept away everywhere the establishments of feudality, so far as requisite, to furnish the bourgeois social system of France with fit surroundings of the European continent, and such as were in keeping with the times. Once the new social establishment was set on foot, the antediluvian giants vanished, and, along with them, the resuscitated Roman world. The Brutuses, Gracchi, Publiculus, the tribunes, the senators, and Caesar himself. In its sober reality, bourgeois society had produced its own true interpretation in the Says, Cousins, Royer Collards, Benjamin Constants, and Guizot's. Its real generals sat behind the office desks, and the mutton head of Louis XVIII was its political lead. This society could no longer understand that the ghosts of Rome had watched over its cradle. And yet, lacking in heroism as bourgeois society is, it nevertheless had stood in need of heroism, of self-sacrifice, of terror, of civil war, and of bloody battlefields to bring it into the world. Its gladiators found in the stern classic traditions of the Roman Republic the ideals and the form, the self-deceptions that they needed in order to conceal from themselves the narrow bourgeois substance of their own struggles, and to keep their passion up to the height of a great historic tragedy. Thus, at another stage of development a century before, did Cromwell and the English people draw from the Old Testament the language, passions, and illusions for their own bourgeois revolution. When the real goal was reached, when the remodeling of English society was accomplished, Locke supplanted Habakkuk. Accordingly, the reviving of the dead in those revolutions served the purpose of glorifying the new struggles, not of parodying the old. It served the purpose of exaggerating to the imagination the given task, not to recoil before its practical solution. It served the purpose of rekindling the revolutionary spirit, not to trot out its ghost. In 1848-51, only the ghost of the old revolution wandered about. From Marast, the Republican in silk stockings, who disguised himself in Old Bailey, down to the adventurer who hid his repulsively trivial features under the iron death mask of Napoleon. A whole people that imagines it has imparted to itself accelerated powers of motion through a revolution suddenly finds itself transferred back to a dead epoch, and, lest there be any mistake possible in this head, the old dates turn up again, the old calendars, the old names, the old edicts, which long since had sunk to the level of antiquarians' learning. Even the old bailiffs, who had long seemed moldering with decay. The nation takes on the appearance of that crazy Englishman in Bedlam, who imagines he is living in the days of the pharaohs, and daily laments the hard work that he must do in the Ethiopian mines as gold digger, immured in a subterranean prison, with a dim lamp fastened on his head, behind him the slave overseer with a long whip, and, at the mouths of the mine, a mob of barbarous camp servants who understand neither the convicts in the mines nor one another, because they do not speak a common language. "And all this," cries the crazy Englishman, "is demanded of me, the free-born Englishman, in order to make gold for old Pharaoh. In order to pay off the debts of the Bonaparte family," sobs the French nation. The Englishman, so long as he was in his senses, could not rid himself of the rooted thought making gold. The Frenchman, so long as they were busy with a revolution, could not rid themselves of the Napoleonic memory, as the election of December 10th proved. They longed to escape from the dangers of revolution back to the fleshpots of Egypt. The 2nd of December, 1851, was the answer. They have not merely the character of the old Napoleon, but the old Napoleon himself, caricatured as he needs must appear in the middle of the 19th century. The social revolution of the 19th century cannot draw its poetry from the past. It can draw that only from the future. It cannot start upon its work before it has stricken off all superstition concerning the past. Former revolutions require historic reminiscences in order to intoxicate themselves with their own issues. The revolutions of the 19th century must let the dead bury their dead in order to reach its issue. With the former, the phrase surpasses the substance. With this one, the substance surpasses the phrase. The February Revolution was a surprisal. Old society was taken unawares. And the people proclaimed this political stroke a great historic act, whereby the new era was opened. On the 2nd of December, the February Revolution is jockeyed by a trick of a false player, and what is seen to be overthrown is no longer the monarchy, but the liberal concessions which had been wrung from it by centuries of struggles. Instead of society itself having conquered a new point, only the state appears to have returned to its oldest form, to the simply brazen rule of the sword and the club. Thus, upon the coup de main of February 1848, comes the response of the coup de tête, December 1851. So won, so lost. Meanwhile, the interval did not go unutilized. During the years 1848 to 1851, French society retrieved an abbreviated, because revolutionary, method the lessons and teachings, which, if it was to be more than a disturbance of the surface, should have preceded the February Revolution, had it developed in regular order, by rule, so to say. Now, French society seems to have receded behind its point of departure. In fact, however, it was compelled to first produce its own revolutionary point of departure, the situation, circumstances, conditions, under which alone the modern revolution is in earnest. Bourgeois revolutions, like those of the 18th century, rush onward rapidly from success to success. Their stage effects outbid one another, men and things seem to be set in flaming brilliance, ecstasy is the prevailing spirit. But they are short-lived. They reach their climax speedily. Then society relapses into a long fit of nervous reaction before it learns how to appropriate the fruits of its period of feverish excitement. Proletarian revolutions, on the contrary, such as those of the 19th century, criticize themselves constantly, interrupt themselves in their own course, come back to what seems to have been accomplished, in order to start over anew. Scorn with cruel thoroughness the half-measures, weaknesses, and meannesses of their first attempts. Seem to throw down their adversary only in order to enable him to draw fresh strength from the earth, and again, to rise up against them in more gigantic stature. Constantly recoil in fear before the unidentified monster magnitude of their own objects, until finally, that situation is created which renders all retreat impossible, and the conditions themselves cry out, "Here is Rhodes! Leap here!" Every observer of average intelligence, even if he failed to follow step by step the course of French development, must have anticipated that an unheard-of fiasco was in store for the revolution. It was enough to hear the self-satisfied yelpings of victory wherewith the Monsieur Democrats mutually congratulated one another upon the pardons of May 2, 1852. Indeed, May 2 had become a fixed idea in their heads. It had become a dogma with them, something like the day on which Christ was to reappear and the millennium to begin had formed in the heads of the Chiliasts. Weakness had, as it ever does, taken refuge in the wonderful. It believed the enemy was overcome if, in its imagination, it hocus-pocused him away. And it lost all sense of the present and the imaginary apotheosis of the future that was at hand, and of the deeds that had it in petto, but which it did not yet want to bring to the scratch. The heroes, whoever seek to refute their established incompetence by mutually bestowing their sympathy upon one another and by pulling together, had packed their satchels, taken their laurels in advanced payments, and were just engaged in the work of getting discounted in partibus on the stock exchange, the republics for which, in the silence of their unassuming dispositions, they had carefully organized the government personnel. The 2nd of December struck them like a bolt from a clear sky. And the peoples, who in periods of timid despondency gladly allow their hidden fears to be drowned by the loudest screamers, will perhaps have become convinced that the days are gone by when the cackling of geese could save the capital. The Constitution, the National Assembly, the dynastic parties, the Blue and the Red Republicans, the heroes from Africa, the thunder from the Tribune, the flashlightings from the daily press, the whole literature, the political names and the intellectual celebrities, the civil and the criminal law, the liberté, égalité, fraternité, together with the 2nd of May 1852, all vanished like phantasmagoria before the ban of one man, whom his enemies themselves do not pronounce an adept of witchcraft. Universal suffrage seems to have survived only for a moment, to the end that, before the eyes of the whole world, it should make its own testament with its own hands, and, in the name of the people, declare, all that exists deserves to perish. It is not enough to say, as the Frenchmen do, that their nation was taken by surprise. A nation, no more than a woman, is excused for the unguarded hour when the first adventurer who comes along can do violence to her. The riddle is not solved by such shrifts, it is only formulated in other words. There remains to be explained how a nation of 36 millions can be surprised by three swindlers and taken to prison without resistance. Let us recapitulate in general outlines the phases which the French Revolution of February 24, 1848 to December 1851 ran through. Three main periods are unmistakable. First, the February period. Second, the period of constituting the Republic, or of the Constitutive National Assembly, May 4, 1848 to May 29, 1849. Third, the period of the Constitutional Republic, or of the Legislative National Assembly, May 29, 1849 to December 2, 1851. The first period, from February 24th, or the downfall of Louis-Philippe, to May 4, 1848, the date of the assembling of the Constitutive Assembly, the February period proper may be designated as the prologue of the Revolution. It officially expressed its own character in this, that the government which it improvised declared itself provisional, and like the government, everything that was broached, attempted, or uttered pronounced itself provisional. Nobody and nothing dared to assume the right of permanent existence and of an actual fact. All the elements that had prepared or determined the revolution, dynastic opposition, republican bourgeoisie, democratic republican small traders class, social democratic labor element, all found provisionally their place in the February government. It could not be otherwise. The February days contemplated originally a reform of the suffrage laws, whereby the area of the politically privileged among the property-holding class was to be extended, while the exclusive rule of the aristocracy of finance was to be overthrown. When, however, it came to a real conflict, when the people mounted the barricades, when the National Guard stood passive, when the army offered no serious resistance, and the kingdom ran away, then the Republic seemed self-understood. Each party interpreted in its own sense. One, arms in hand, by the proletariat, they put upon it the stamp of their own class and proclaimed a social republic. Thus, the general purpose of modern revolutions was indicated, a purpose, however, that stood in most singular contradiction to everything that, with the material at hand, with the stage of enlightenment that the masses had reached, and under existing circumstances and conditions, could be immediately used. On the other hand, the claims of all the other elements that had cooperated in the Revolution of February were recognized by the lion's share that they received in the government. Hence, in no period do we find a more motley mixture of high-sounding phrases together with actual doubt and helplessness, of more enthusiastic reform aspirations together with a more slavish adherence to the old routine, more seeming harmony permeating the whole of society together with a deeper alienation of its several elements. While the Parisian proletariat was still gloating over the sight of the great perspective that had disclosed itself to their view, and was indulging in seriously meant discussions over the social problems, the old powers of society had groomed themselves, had gathered together, had deliberated, and found an unexpected support in the mass of the nation. The peasants and small traders, all of whom threw themselves on a sudden upon the political stage after the barriers of the July monarchy had fallen down. The second period, from May 4, 1848, to the end of May 1849, is the period of the Constitution, of the founding of the bourgeois republic immediately after the February days. Not only was the dynastic opposition surprised by the republicans, and the republicans by the socialists, but all of France was surprised by Paris. The National Assembly, that met on May 4, 1848, to frame a constitution, was the outcome of the national elections. It represented the nation. It was a living protest against the assumption of the February days, and it was intended to bring the results of the revolution back to the bourgeois measure. In vain did the proletariat of Paris, which forthwith understood the character of this National Assembly, endeavor, a few days after its meeting, on May 15th, to deny its existence by force, to dissolve it, to disperse the organic apparition in which the reacting spirit of the nation was threatening them, and thus reduce it back to its separate component parts. As is known, the 15th of May had no other result than that of removing Blanqui and his associates, i.e., the real leaders of the proletarian party, from the public scene for the whole period of the cycle which we are here considering. Upon the bourgeois monarchy of Louis-Philippe, only the bourgeois republic could follow. That is to say, a limited portion of the bourgeoisie having ruled under the name of the king, now the whole bourgeoisie was to rule under the name of the people. The demands of the Parisian proletariat are utopian tomfooleries that have to be done away with. To this declaration of the Constitutional National Assembly, the Paris proletariat answers with a June insurrection, the most colossal event in the history of European civil wars. The bourgeois republic won. On its side stood the aristocracy of finance, the industrial bourgeoisie, the middle class, the small traders class, the army, the slums organized as garde mobile, the intellectual celebrities, the parsons class, and the rural population. On the side of the Parisian proletariat stood none but itself. Over 3,000 insurgents were massacred. After the victory, 15,000 were transported without trial. With this defeat, the proletarian steps to the background of the revolutionary stage. It always seeks to crowd forward, so soon as the movement seems to acquire new impetus, but with ever weaker effort and ever smaller results. So soon as any of the above-lying layers of society gets into revolutionary fermentation, it enters into alliance therewith, and thus shares all the defeats which the several parties successively suffer. But these succeeding blows become ever weaker the more generally they are distributed over the whole surface of society. The more important leaders of the proletariat, in its councils, and the press, fall one after another, victims of the courts, and never more questionable figures step to the front. It partly throws itself upon doctrinaire experiments, cooperative banking, and labor exchange schemes, in other words, movements, in which it gives up the task of revolutionizing the old world with its own large collective weapons, and on the contrary, seeks to bring about its emancipation behind the back of society in private ways, within the narrow bounds of its own class conditions, and consequently, inevitably fails. The proletariat seems to be able neither to find again the revolutionary magnitude within itself, nor to draw new energy from the newly formed alliances until all classes, with whom it contended in June, shall lie prostrate along with itself. But in all these defeats, the proletariat succumbs at least with the honor that attaches to great historic struggles. Not France alone. All Europe trembles before the June earthquake, while the successive defeats inflicted upon the higher classes are bought so easily that they need the brazen exaggeration of the victorious party itself to be at all able to pass muster as an event. And these defeats become more disgraceful the further removed the defeated party stands from the proletariat. True enough, the defeat of the June insurgents prepared leveled the ground upon which the bourgeois republic could be founded and erected. But it, at the same time, showed that there are in Europe other issues besides that of the republic or monarchy. It revealed the fact that here the bourgeois republic meant the unbridled despotism of one class over another. It proved that, with nations enjoying an older civilization, having developed class distinctions, modern conditions of production, an intellectual consciousness, wherein all traditions of old have been dissolved through the work of centuries, that with such countries, the republic means only the political revolutionary form of bourgeois society, not its conservative form of existence, as is the case in the United States of America, where, true enough, the classes already exist, but have not yet acquired permanent character, are in constant flux and reflux, constantly changing their elements and yielding them up to one another, where the modern means of production, instead of coinciding with a stagnant population, rather compensate for the relative scarcity of heads and hands. And finally, where the feverishly youthful life of material production, which has to appropriate a new world to itself, has so far left neither time nor opportunity to abolish the illusions of old. All classes and parties joined hands in the June days in a party of order against the class of the proletariat, which was designated as the party of anarchy, of socialism, of communism. They claimed to have saved society against the enemies of society. They gave out the slogans of the old social order: property, family, religion, order, as the passwords for their army, and cried out to the counter-revolutionary crusaders, "In this sign thou wilt conquer." From that moment on, so soon as any of the numerous parties which had marshaled themselves under this sign against the June insurgents tries, in turn, to take the revolutionary field in the interests of its own class, it goes down in its turn before the cry, "Property, family, religion, order." Thus, it happens that society is saved, as often as the circle of its ruling class is narrowed, and as often as a more exclusive interest asserts itself over the general. Every demand for the most simple bourgeois financial reform, for the most ordinary liberalism, for the most commonplace republicanism, for the flattest democracy, is forthwith punished as an assault upon society and is branded as socialism. Finally, the high priests of religion and order themselves are kicked off their tripods, are fetched out of their beds in the dark, hurried into the patrol wagons, thrust into jail, or sent into exile. Their temple is razed to the ground. Their mouths are sealed. Their pen is broken. Their law torn to pieces in the name of religion, of family, of property, and of order. Bourgeois, fanatic on the point of order, are shot down in their own balconies by drunken soldiers, forfeit their family property, and their houses are bombarded for pastime, all in the name of property, of family, of religion, and of order. Finally, the refuse of bourgeois society constitutes the holy phalanx of order, and the hero Krapulinsky makes his entry into the Tuileries as the savior of society.